Hi.
How you doing? How you doing? How you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
So, first of all, welcome to World Music Views, the premier music business platform out of Jamaica. We're the first to talk about music business from an intellectual property standpoint, but we're driven by artists. So we cover the issues affecting artists, producers, songwriters, singers, dancers, like whoever is popping, reggae, dancehall, Afrobeats. Hip hop is in there. Afrobeat's definitely in there. And I saw you talking about a particular lawsuit. I don't know if you were alluding to it. And I started to research and realize that you are keenly focused on music rights. Am I correct?
Sure.
So first, tell us who you are, how you got your present job.
I'm Brian McBrady, and I'm a forensic musicologist. And a forensic musicologist assists in illuminating the matters of music in matters of music copyright.
Oh, wow. So you're the perfect person to talk to.
We'll see.
How does one become a forensic musicologist?
You can arrive at it lots of different ways. I mean, there's musicology study, but most often musicology study focuses on ethnomusicology or similar, which is not really so much about copyright and or even and or law, but about sociology and how music relates to culture and history. But a forensic musicologist is a little bit more theory based and has to have a familiarity with music history and has to know quite a bit of music theory and has to have a familiarity with copyright law so that he can or she can apply that music knowledge as it pertains to a usually a civil lawsuit.
So, how acquainted are you with reggae dancehall culture?
Not very. In fact, my only exposure to dance hall is from what I've looked into regarding the lawsuit that I imagine you're going to talk about. That involves Steely and Cleavey and a lot of the biggest reggaeton artists in the world.
All right, so let's get straight to it. Steely and Cleavey, I interviewed Cleavey on World Music Views, and you
Did
can check
you?
out on worldmusicviews.com, where we talked about the lawsuit somewhat. He was quite avoidant because it's an ongoing process.
Sure.
This week, I believe it goes to court. And he said that he created this beat Fish Market in the 80s. He has a secret ingredient. This much he said. There's a secret ingredient in there that it has been copied by over 1,800 songs subsequent to the lawsuit, right? According to the lawsuit. Based on your knowledge, first of all, from your educated standpoint, tell us what you know about the suit and how likely are they to win?
I know that there are over 1,000 songs named in the lawsuit, and that there are dozens of defendants. And from what I can tell, the basic style that we associate most with reggaeton, chiefly the drum beat that's beneath it, although I think the plaintiffs in this case would say there's a little bit more to it than that, but it's chiefly that. The long and short of it is that I don't find the elements that they see across those hundreds of those dozens of songs or thousands of songs and dozens of defendants' repertoires. The things that they find evident in all those pieces of music are not the kinds of things that copyright usually seeks to protect. And I think part of the reason is that copyright wants to promote new music, and it wants to do that through balancing, incentivizing you to create new music by promising that they'll protect your IP into the future, but not doing that so stringently that they prevent others from being able to make music that is somewhat similar to what has come before. And the kinds of elements that are in Fish Market that they're seeking to claim should not be proliferated across a genre without a license, in my estimation, those are the kinds of things that copyright would say are building blocks available to all, and that society wants people to be able to create music with a little bit of those commonalities in it. And I think that makes sense. If all music was truly unique, then every time you put on Spotify or whatever your music source is, you would have a learning curve, a little bit of unfamiliarity. You want the music that you're listening to when it's new to be relatable to something that you know before. And then you want it to have certain elements that are new and fresh. And I think as a listener, you know, that's part of the fun of music. You don't want it to be so weird that you can't enjoy it. The rhythm that's in Fish Market has a lot of very basic elements in it. It has a couple of things that might have made it Fish Market, but those, in my estimation, are not the things that are in 1,000 different songs. The elements that are in 1,000 different songs are extremely basic and brief and not protectable. And I think that's probably how this is going to go.
So Fish Market spawns Dembo, which Dembo is a song by Shabaranks done over as a rhythm and used as the Dembo genre, which was originated in Puerto Rico and built in Panama. Reggaeton, as the name suggests, is a spin-off of reggae. So you're saying that Dembo and reggaeton, although influenced by Fish Market, which spawned Dembo, has no right of copy?
I'm saying who has no right of copy? I'm sorry, say that again.
Fish Market spawns Dembo, which is a song by Shabaranks. So Steely and Clevie created Fish Market. Okay. Bobby Digital, the producer, created a song named Dembo, inspired by the Fish Market rhythm. Dembo is then interpolated and used on the same groove, same melody, same beat, to create a genre of music called Dembo. It's a Spanish genre. Reggaeton, which is built in Panama by El General, that is also, as the name suggests, is a spin-off of reggae music, right? Which is upbeat dancehall music. Are you saying both the original Dembo song, which comes from the Fish Market, has no right of copy to Dembo, the genre, and reggaeton, the genre?
It sounds like I would probably agree with that, unless, well, use the word interpolate. If one song interpolates another, that means it quotes it. And if it quotes it in such a way that I would recognize it as being a quote from a specific song and not, you can, well, let's just take an aspect of the Fish Market rhythm. The Fish Market rhythm contains a bass drum part that's going boom, 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 boom. And if you go to write a song today that has that same, what we call four on the floor, because you're going to hit the bass drum every beat for four beats per measure, you could say, I'm interpolating Fish Market. But you wouldn't be interpolating an original aspect of Fish Market. It's a bass drum every four beats. It's not unique to Fish Market. So you, the creator, you may see that as, well, I'm going to take that from Fish Market. But you're not taking it specifically from Fish Market. You might be in your mind doing that, But Fish Market has no claim on that. It's not unique enough to Fish Market. So to take this many, many layers away, 30, 40 years ago, drum machines were built that had 16-step sequencers in them so that you could build a rhythm. And the 16 steps were analogous to 16th notes, which means that there were 16 of them in a measure. And you would, I don't know, hit click, or if you're using a hardware drum machine, you would make selections across those 16, and you might choose to put the bass drum on the first of every group of four, which would put it four beats to the measure, and you might tap out a bunch of hi-hats and get something that goes either every one of those 16 notes is going taka 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 taka, or maybe just some of them tak ta taka ta taka ta ta taka, and then it would repeat and repeat and repeat, and you'd build a rhythm that way. I would argue that for a very short amount of music, one measure, two measures, which is what we're talking about here, it is far from a certainty that any one person can know that they were the first to create a rhythm, you know, four or five instruments deep and only 16 steps wide, that was truly theirs. This is the kind of argument that I'm making against the idea that this truly was claimable as original by anybody. And then subsequently, that any person who does it subsequently should necessarily be beholden to that originator, perhaps originator.
So,
and that's the main challenge for this whole thing. The lack of originality, the lack of uniqueness, and that's a function of the lack of length of the music, the number of elements that are in the music, and the tiny bit of originality that could possibly be in the music, because it's just not novel. It's built on ordinary rhythms. So it's very hard for me to see any protectable originality in this. I think that's going to be the main challenge for them.
So other than originality, let's say on the 22nd, the judge decides there's originality. They're going to court with it, right?
Yes.
The rhythm wasn't registered till 2020. Then Bao, they recently, like a month ago, got the copyright from the U.S. Copyright Office for the Dembow, which is authored by Rexton Ralston, which is Shabaranks, Steely, and Cleavey. They recently got that. Is
there a registered the copyright?
Yeah, they recently registered, recently got it back.
Yeah.
Do they have a problem claiming on a 1989 rhythm that they just got the copyright for a month ago and 2 years ago?
First of all, I'm not a lawyer, so I would be reluctant to give an answer with any kind of promise that I would know the limitations of it. What I can say is that copyright vests in the creator when you create the work. So they have had copyright of Fish Market. This does not contradict what I said before. I'm not saying Fish Market itself isn't original. Fish Market was in its entirety an original work. And they had copyright over the entire thing at the point of creation in fixed form, which means when they recorded it, when they got it down to a hard drive, when they got it down into a tape, however they rendered it, that fixed form is the expression. So copyright exists at that point. U.S. law requires that you have a registered copyright before you can actually produce a lawsuit, before you can protect those rights. But the rights are there the whole while. But there may be some limitations to what you can do in court that are dependent upon when you actually do the registration. it's not that they weren't, it's not that they didn't have copyright previous. It's just there might be a few limitations, but it won't, in my estimation, it's not the kind of thing that's going to derail this whole thing, certainly.
What, and I say you're not a lawyer, but I just want to know from your forensic musicologist perspective, what value does precedence have on this case? For example, there's the Miley Cyrus Flower Gun case, where Flower Gun, another dancehall artist, sued Miley Cyrus for $300 million. They settled out of court for an undisclosed amount, but he basically won by getting the settlement. What value is precedence for a case like this?
Precedent is of a lot of value in general, but whether the Miley Cyrus case is applicable here, I don't know. I'm actually not familiar with the music of musicology in that. So it'd be a very specific comparison. If I were to say, you know, what about that case is similar to this one, that would be much more complicated than I could just answer in a really general sense. It might have precedent, but I'm afraid I don't know.
Do you see any other cases that are similar to this one?
I don't see any cases that support it. I primarily see limits on originality and on decisions where courts ascribed originality to simple bits of music. I know that one way to argue for infringement is to claim what's called selection and arrangement. And that might become kind of, I wouldn't want to characterize it in this case, but in general, it can become a bit of a plan B. If someone like me says, well, the parts in that rhythm aren't original and protectable, there's an idea called selection and arrangement that says that a numerous enough number of elements, which themselves might not be protectable, arranged in a way that is unique and original, might then itself, that arrangement of a bunch of unprotectable simple elements, the arrangement of those might itself be protectable. But the bar for that, in some ways, not in every way, but in some ways, can be a little bit high to get over. You need to have a certain number of elements. A couple of elements won't do it. And then you tend also to need those elements to be very similarly, almost identically used in another work. So if I just remember what I saw from the way this was originally argued, they're trying to sue against a whole genre, but you take two songs and you compare them and say, well, you have a plaintiff and you have a Bad Bunny or a Daddy Yankee or someone, and they're going to show their specific song. If you have a fish market rhythm that has, say, eight layers of instruments going by that create the rhythm, but they only find five of them in, you know, I'm not thinking of any particular song, but, you know, name one, they only find five of them. Two of them are the same. A couple of them are kind of the same. Once you start getting kind of the same, then someone says, well, that's not a perfect enough copy to get a selection and arrangement. Selection and arrangement is the idea that this is the element. It's not protectable, but you selected it. And then so did this other person. Select all of these exact same elements and put them in a piece of music in the same way. So it's a little bit tricky to describe, but if you hear about selection and arrangement, that's the kind of thing that describes.
There's another case in dancehall music. There's a song called Drift. So Drift, the rhythm for Drift was created by one guy. It was given to another guy to produce the song Drift. And then another guy put his lyrics Drift on the rhythm. And then Warner signed the guy that sang the song on the rhythm based on the success of Drift. Drift was also used by a major telecoms company for an ad, because the company signed the singer who sang the song Drift. And then the beat maker and the producer were left out of the deal to get the song in the commercial. And then it caused a whole stir. Who has rights to that? And what are the different rights from beat maker to producer to singer?
Well, actually, there's something about the fish market case that that I didn't really answer before, and I'm not sure what's going on with Drift exactly, but and we can describe it a second time if you want, and maybe make sure that I've got it straight. But my first thought is that if they put a recording called Drift in the in a commercial or in a campaign, that they needed to have a license to use the audio, which is very different from what we've been talking about. It's possible that across 1,000 songs that are in the fish market lawsuit, that some of their claims involve the audio. And we throw around the word sample too. They've sampled the composition, but you don't really sample a composition so much as you copy and unlawfully appropriate a composition. That's when you make another song that sounds, that uses the same compositional elements as the first one. But if you actually took a snippet of the audio and incorporated it into your new piece, that's a sample. And there's a very, very long list of songs, and there's different claims that are made on each of them. And it seems to me that some of them say samples the composition, and some of them say samples the, I don't know if it says samples the audio or not. But in terms of who has these, this and that rights, those are separate copyrights. And one much more specific than the other. If we don't find the actual audio in the defendant's music, then they didn't sample it. So if you want to go back over the Drift thing again, it's hard to do it. This is my first time hearing about it. So but I'd be happy to comment on it if I can figure it out.
The Drift song by TJ, he signed to Warner Publishing and Warner Record Label from the success of that one song, because the song blew up on TikTok.
Hey. He's a beat maker.
No, he's a singer.
Oh, he's a singer. Okay, so it's his. Yeah. So everybody regards it as his song.
Yeah, but the song first had a beat maker before he got it, and the song had a producer separate. So the beat maker gave it to the producer, and there's a discrepancy as to who has rights. But remember, Warner just signed the guy, but it didn't sign the producer.
He signed the beat maker, or he signed the artist?
The artist.
Okay. Well, did the artist buy the beat?
No.
Or did the license the beat?
No.
Nothing?
No deal. No, nothing was written down. Nothing. Like, nothing.
Oh, see, this all gets very complicated and difficult to speculate about without knowing exactly where the chain of custody and the licensing or the ownership of this goes.
So the public conversation is that a man, one called the other and said, hey, I need this song. And the one sent it to him and he recorded the song, and then he sent it to another guy to make the song better. And then they released the song. The song blew up. The guy blew up, and that's it.
Yeah. I'm afraid there's too many moving parts in that for me to have any sort of opinion. I'm sorry. I'd love to contribute to the conversation.
That's cool.
There's possibilities.
A lot of that happens in reggae dancehall music because there's a lot of informalities that happen.
Yes,
and what I really wanted to comment on is the difference between a beat maker, a producer, and an artist, and the different rights of copies associated with all three.
Okay, well, a beat is more than just a rhythm, right? A beat can be a pretty well finished instrumental track, and it can contain plenty of intellectual property that is protectable. So perhaps that's the first answer to your question. The beat maker can have a claim on the beat, certainly the kind of a beat can be original and protectable. If that beat winds up in another piece of music, whether it's an audio sample or whether the beat is copied compositionally, either one of those, the intellectual property could reside in the beat maker. The artist, presumably going to create a lyric, possibly a melody, possibly add other instrumental elements atop that, and we'll have his own intellectual property, her own intellectual property atop the beat. And then ownership, though, then becomes contractual. So as you said, in the absence of a contract, this gets to be a legal matter. And this is where, again, I have to say I'm not a lawyer. But if you create a beat and you don't license it to somebody else, it's probably your beat. So if, as you said, there was no paperwork, then it could be a matter of, I don't know, whether there was consideration, which is, whether someone got paid for it, how you intended it to be used. You start guessing about intent, it starts to get very complicated. I suppose above and all in this is the old get it in writing adage. So I understand that doesn't necessarily happen all the time. In fact, it happens. It's unbelievably common that it doesn't happen at all, and this has to be figured out. But it becomes much more a legal matter than a musical matter. And that's not really my wheelhouse.
So the law firm representing the music label is against Tillian Cleavey. It's the same label that represented Ed Sheeran, right? Are there similarities with the Ed Sheeran case versus Marvin Gaye?
Well, one similarity is that selection and arrangement idea. So the Ed Sheeran case, in the end, when it mattered, was a selection and arrangement argument. The idea was that if the chord progression, which was similar to these two works, but not unique to these two works and not original to Let's Get It On, if you began to concede that maybe we've heard this chord progression before, you start saying, okay, the chord progression itself wasn't original, but the chord progression is rendered with a certain in a certain rhythm, right? And then you say, so we have a rhythm that's not protectable, and we have a series of chords that's not protectable, but can we call those two different elements and say, so both of those elements wound up in Let's Get It On. There's two. And then you can try to find another element, but it frankly in this case was hard. And only two is not very many. And the thing about a chord progression, well, it's hard to render a chord progression. It's hard to perform a chord progression without it having a rhythm. So to call that two different elements is a little theoretical. It's the chord progression, and it goes boom, 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 boom. Basically, I can only sing one note at a time, and we had heard that before. In the end, that case wasn't decided on whether the two were substantially similar. It was decided on the jury's decision that Sheeran hadn't copied it.
So the jury will be who decides if this case goes to court.
Yes. Well, if it goes to court in, as you said, it looks like it's going to go to court soon. This would be a jury decision.
But add this to it. Is it possible that you or another forensic musicologist will be called to say what you're telling me now?
Yeah, that will happen. In fact, I'm looking at what I think is the original complaint, and there's rather a lot of musicology in it. I'm looking right now at at a breakdown of the Fish Market beat. And as I scroll through this, I see breakdowns, notation, transcriptions of some of the songs that are on the list of defendants. And so there's quite a bit of musicology already been done.
Yep. So World Music Views, we're actually the first to report on it, and then everybody started to copy, because we're very much interested in how this plays out, because it's a landmark case. If it does get won or they lose, it's going to set a precedence that, you know, it's going to affect either genre.
It's going, well, you can't, if it goes a certain way, it's going to go that way in, you know, in ink, and people will be able to point to it. So to that extent, it would be a precedent. But I have to go back to to everything I said originally. This would be an odd outcome. And if everybody who wants to go boom, get boom, get boom, get boom, get in the future has to go back and get a license for Fish Market, you know, reggaeton as we know it won't necessarily go away, but there'll be a lot less of it. And that would fly in the face, I think, of the other thing that I said, which is that society wants a bunch of music that it can enjoy. And copyright is meant to promote that. And a decision like the one you're describing would fly in the face of that. So I think it's very unlikely, but we'll see. We'll get together again afterward.
What do you do every day as a forensic musicologist?
It changes from day to day, but you know, ordinarily you're doing exactly this. You're taking two pieces of music where someone has made an observation that there's a similarity in song A and in song B. And then you are first validating whether their observation is correct and elements are in song B that are similar to song A. And then you are evaluating whether those amount to enough that anybody should care. And that's partly a function of whether the elements that are in song A are original to song A, and whether the elements appearing in song B is, as we say, probative of copying, which means, is the fact that this appears in song B, does that lead us to infer that the writer of song B got it from song A? And if the element is very unique to song A, then we might make that inference. And if the element is not very unique to song A, then we would make the other inference that, no, in let's say Ed Sheeran could have gotten this from anywhere, from many, many other places, might have gotten it from nowhere. For example,
and we got 5 minutes left, so I want to squeeze.
So it's that kind of thing. It's that kind of thing all the time.
Yeah, I want to squeeze in another question, or two questions actually. So to be clear, reggaeton, as far as you see it from a musicologist's perspective, owes no dues to dancehall music.
There are dues, and there are infringements. Dues, you know, due in the way of due respect, due deference, due, you know, appreciation, all of those things can be due. But yeah, do you need to get a license from somebody? You know, not for those elements. You know, a bunch of the songs in the thousand. And there's a point at which you go, well, that's clearly that song. But the elements that we're talking about, you know, you might be able to draw a line back to Fish Market for some of them, but you can't necessarily. They're just
so for those some, simple. They might win for those some, and not for the others.
I haven't personally seen any that I think will. But I should admit, I've only looked at a handful, specific ones.
And do you?
And I haven't looked at all at the possibility that audio is actually in a song B.
Okay. Do you work for record labels, with record labels, or just independently?
Could be either one.
So anybody can contract you as a musicologist to help them figure stuff out.
Yes. So, yes, and you could contract me as a musicologist to take two songs and provide an opinion.
Who are your main clients, though, every day?
My main clients are in the advertising business.
I'm in the advertising business.
Increasingly, people would like to know that their risk is minimized. So before anything bad happens, before anybody comes knocking, before anybody comes and makes an accusation, they would like to have exercised some care and caution and make sure they're not going to have a problem or do their best to mitigate the possibility.
Fact.